This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Unemployment is high and officials say headed higher. Wall Street bounced back a bit last week, but stocks are still worth about half of what they were. There's serious talk of nationalizing the banks. The value of houses continues to drop most places. Foreclosures mount, and almost everybody has problems getting credit. New York Times columnist and author Thomas Friedman calls this moment a great inflection. And today we talk to him as part of a series of conversations to examine the economy and how it's changing our jobs, our relationship with government, and our assumptions about success and what that means in America. Later in the program, we'll get to the outrage over bonuses at AIG and hear an argument that government should not micromanage bailed out financial firms. But first, this economic moment, how is the crisis changing the economy as far as you can see? What's changed? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Thomas Friedman is a columnist for the New York Times. His most recent book is Hot, Flat, and Crowded, Why We Need a Green Revolution and How It Can Renew America. And he joins us today from his office here in Washington. Nice to have you back on the program.
Great to be with you.
And is this just a bump in the road, maybe a big bump in the road, or is something more profound going on here?
Well, the argument I made in a column the other day, Neil, was this, that I don't think this is just a bump in the road. I think that, Mother Nature and the market both hit a wall here. And what I mean by that is this, we've created a way of raising standards of living in our country and others that basically worked like this. We built more and more stores to sell more and more stuff that triggered more and more factories in China, powered by more and more coal, that earned more and more dollars, that were used to buy more and more T-bills, that were recirculated back to America to build more and more stores, to sell more and more stuff. And that whole circle, that whole loop, was basically a system for raising standards of living that lived off what I would call stocks, not flows. It lived off principal, not interest. We were reducing our natural and real capital to keep all of that going. And I don't think that was a system that we could pass on to our kids. It is basically reaching both its market and climate limits. We need to find different ways to grow our standards of living that are not going to, at the same time, create an unlivable climate and an unlivable planet.
I think we all see the economic fallout from that. Tell us more about the climate, how that fits.
Well, what's really interesting is if you, noise, and it's more than just noise, the roar of the financial crisis has really overwhelmed all other news, and it's totally understandable. But if you do follow the climate science, as I do, what's actually been happening almost in lockstep with the falling of the Dow has been a spate of reports over the next 6 months that all begin with some variation of the following theme. A group of scientists gathered here at, MIT, the Met Center in England, Stanford University, have looked at the latest climate reports and modeling and concluded that climate change is coming faster, that average temperatures are rising farther, and that sea level rise will happen sooner than we anticipated just a couple of years ago. Now, one of the problems is we don't have a climate Dow. With the Dow, you just flip on CNN, my eye goes repeatedly to the bottom of the right-hand corner. I see in either red numbers or green numbers how the market is doing. Mother Nature doesn't have a Dow. And as environmentalists would say, Mother Nature also doesn't do bailouts. And so, you can't negotiate with Mother Nature. My friend Rob Watson, a great environmentalist, the founder of LEED Buildings. Rob always likes to say, Mother Nature, she's just chemistry, biology, and physics, Tom. That's all she is. And she's just going to do what chemistry, biology, and physics dictate. And the thing about Mother Nature, she always bats last, and she always bats 1,000. You can't spin her. You can't say, Mother Nature, we're having a terrible depression, first since 1929. Could you give us a break for a couple of years? No, she's just going to do what she's going to do. But ultimately, while Mother Nature doesn't do bailouts, human beings do. And just as we need a financial bailout, We're also going to need a climate bailout.
And as we look at that, another recent column you wrote was said this is 9/12. This is the day after Pearl Harbor. There's nothing more important than to heal our banks. Well, how do we do that and address the environment and address health care and address education and address all the other issues?
Of course, that's a challenge, and you got to do things in sequence. One of the problems with the bank crisis is that when your 401k is falling, it's really hard to get worried about your sea level rising in 50 years. And so there's a kind of asymmetry in time, even though things we are doing right now will be felt by our children, grandchildren, and their grandchildren. And so to me, priority number one is obviously come up with a solution for the banking crisis. I think the administration's going to give us that very shortly. Whether it'll work, I don't know. I make no predictions whatsoever. But I think the long-awaited plan is coming, And at the same time, while we have this stimulus bill out there, and we'll probably need yet another stimulus, let's use those to really focus on the climate solutions, Neil, that we know that work. We know that mandating higher efficiency for buildings works. It's been demonstrated in California. We know that improving mileage standards work. It's been demonstrated in Europe and Japan. We know that decoupling utilities so they're paid not for how much electricity they get you to use, but how much electricity they get you to save, which they're now doing in California, we know that works. We know putting a price on carbon works. So, let's take the things we know that work and let's really scale them like nobody's business with the new stimulus we have and with the initiatives we can do even after we get the banking crisis resolved.
And we're also going to talk with Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist and author, about how the economy is going to be looking differently after we come out of this. We'd like to hear from you, too. How is the economy where you live changing? What do you see? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Ray's on the line from Charlottesville in Virginia.
Yes, hi, Neil. I'm going on my 10th year of a small home remodeling business here in Central Virginia, and I've seen it go from being pretty lucrative down to an absolute trickle. Drive down the road anywhere and you see pickup trucks and vans for sale with company names on the sides of them. Walk into the Lowe's, the main Lowe's in Charlottesville, at 9 o'clock in the morning, the place is a ghost town. All my suppliers are singing the blues. Nobody's selling anything.
And do you see any light at the end of the tunnel?
I believe that the two things have to happen for this economy to rebound, and I applaud Barack Obama's stimulus package, but I don't think it's going to help. I believe that your average consumer is lost faith and trust, and that we're saving every penny. I'm not spending a dime on anything. I have to worry about gas prices going through the roof again. I have to worry about food prices going through the roof again. And until those two things, which is what every consumer, whether you are rich or poor, you have to buy gas and you have to buy food. When those things come down and maybe we get some assurances that they're not going to skyrocket again, then I think people will start spending money again. I mean, we are the economy. The middle class, we run the economy. It's our spending that makes it move. And the people here in Charlottesville, no one's spending a dime. You walk into restaurants, they're empty. You walk into clothing stores, the places are empty. The mall is closing down stores. I mean, it's bad. It's real bad here.
Tom Friedman, Ray could be describing a lot of places other than Charlottetown in Virginia, and it's interesting what he says about loss of faith.
Well, I think Ray is absolutely, he's a great reporter. He could be, he's every man and he's every town. And the thing I would say to Ray is exactly why I'm focused on the banks. Why is it? Our banks, big, local, regional, and national, they're really the heart. They're the heart that pumps blood to our industrial muscles. And right now as a country, as Ray alludes, we have congestive heart failure. Our heart is working at about 10% capacity. And so, as Ray said, the stimulus has been a drop in the bucket. It is because compared to banks, Neil, banks are stimulating 24/7. They're giving, when they're working, they're giving home loans and car loans and home repair loans. They're giving, you know, startup loans, and they're doing it 24/7, 365.
And you've written that there's a lot of money and a lot of investors out there just waiting for an opportunity.
Exactly, but why are they waiting? Because they're worried that if they go too soon, that what Ray's talked about, that because everyone's saving, that, you know, they're going to leap into an empty pool. What they're waiting for is some clarity that says, okay, now I know what the rules for investing for banks are. Now I see what the plan is. I think when that happens, and I wouldn't even begin to predict when, but when it does, there's a $1 trillion or more on the sideline that's going to say, wow, the American economy is on sale, and I don't want to miss it.
Ray, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And good luck to you. But Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said over the weekend he sees, well, you know, the recession could begin to turn around by the end of this year, but he had a big if.
Well, again, if Neil goes back to the banks, there's no healthy body without a heart that's functioning. And there's no healthy economy without a banking system that's efficiently taking money from savers and redistributing it to inventors and innovators and startups and new businesses. And until we get that, and that's why I've been obsessive about that, until you get that going, there's not much else to talk about.
But is it fair for the American taxpayer to keep bailing out the people who screwed up so badly in the first place?
Oh, it's totally unfair. You know, and by the way, it's going to get even more unfair, because when they actually unveil the plan, the money we have spent so far, the $350 billion in the TARP and the $800 billion of stimulus roughly, that was just to prevent systemic failure. That was to prevent the body from dying. But in terms of the therapy and getting this body back to health, it's going to take even more money. And it is grotesquely unfair what we've had to do to keep some of these institutions alive, and we've only done it for one reason, because the cost of the system failing was greater than the cost of keeping these people alive. But fairness left the building a long time ago.
We're talking with Tom Friedman of the New York Times. More in a moment about the economic crisis, its causes, and its possibilities. How is the crisis changing the economy as far as you can see? 800-989-8255, or zap us an email, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a recent column in the New York Times, Thomas Friedman argued that we may remember 2008 as the year when the economy and Mother Nature both said no more. But he also says he's an optimist. People are already using this economic slowdown to retool and reorient economies. Today, Tom Friedman joins us to talk as part of our series on this economic moment. Tom Friedman, of course, also the author of Hot, Flat, and Crowded, Why We Need a Green Revolution and How It Can Renew America. How is the crisis changing the economy as far as you can see? Tell us your story, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. And Tom Friedman, I wanted to ask you about that last part. We were talking about the prescriptive part about healing the banks. What evidence do you see that the economy is shifting from that unsustainable model you talked about a few minutes ago to something new?
It's very interesting. I've been on book tour for the last 6 months, and I've been to big towns, small towns, big universities, small universities. And as I've written, and I say at every stop, you know, it's interesting whenever I, you know, talk to people afterwards or do a book signing. And at the end of the day, I go back to my hotel and I empty my pocket of business cards from energy innovators. You know, rock stars get room keys. I get business cards, okay? And they're business cards from people. I've got a solar company. I got a wind company. I got a cellulosa company. I got a duck. It paddles a wheel, blows up a balloon, issues methane, turns a turbine. I hear the craziest stuff. But it is incredibly exciting. The country is exploding with innovation from the ground up. Here's my last week. I go to Sarasota, Florida, and they tell me that they're working on building the America's, I think, biggest or first urban solar farm, basically. on land that City Foundation Group has got in Sarasota. I go from there to Muncie, Illinois, to Ball State University. They're working on plans to install the first baseload geothermal power plant that will replace the university's coal-fired power plant. I go from there to Lawrence Livermore Lab. They're working on this incredibly exciting laser energy fusion project that has the potential. It's still a ways off, but the potential to give us baseload fusion power. Everywhere I go, people are coming up to me and telling me about these incredible initiatives started by sometimes small companies, started by groups, and they're exploding all over the country.
And I don't need to point out to you, you wrote it in your column yourself, all of these solutions seem to be about 20 years away and always will be.
Some of them. Not all. The fusion one, you know, that's always the charge. But, you know, that's fusion that was done in little labs. We're not doing laser-driven fusion with 192 lasers at Lawrence Livermore. These are the guys who build our nuclear weapons. This is not your neighbor in his garage. This is the real deal.
Let's get some more callers on the line. We'll talk with James. James with us from Boulder, Colorado.
Hey, Neil. I'm very much enjoying you guys. And I just wanted to add, it seemed to me that America is experiencing an urban explosion. For as the poverty, for as the lack of money, the lack of representation, crime is going up, so forth and so on. I think we have to get a little more deeper with our true problems in this country. And as long as we incorporate poverty, it has access to us all. And unless we come to terms with that, these problems won't go away.
So you think we've got more to fall before we begin to focus on the real problems?
I think, like I said, I think we're having an urban explosion now across the country because for some people, this ain't nothing new. But for the reality of how we're going to fix it is that, I'm always kind of reminded of how all of our leaders generally are over 60, and that might have a lot to do with the progress really needs that need to come into play. We need a lot of more young people involved. We need a lot of more vision, and we need a lot of more push. And like I said, I think as far as the urban explosion that's going across the country, all I can say is welcome to the hood.
Okay, Jeff. Thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Welcome to the hood, Tom Friedman.
Well, you know, this is a bonfire of the vanities moment, to recall Tom Wolfe's classic about Wall Street, you know. And I think we really need to make sure that the really justifiable anger that people feel now about, you know, bonuses to AIG bankers who ran up the biggest quarterly loss in the history of the Milky Way galaxy, that the justifiable anger over that is addressed and is not allowed to overwhelm what are going to have to be more payouts in the future to get us out of this crisis.
Yet there is an aspect of what James had to say, which is, I guess it's the Rahm Emanuel quote, admittedly before he took office, but which was never let a good crisis go to waste.
It's actually came from Paul Romer, Stanford economist, who said a crisis is a terrible thing to waste.
Okay.
That's okay.
Well, then I'm misquoting Rahm Emanuel. But anyway,
Rahm did a nice adaptation of it, though. It is a terrible thing to waste, and I hope we don't waste it. And I'm a big believer in human ingenuity. People don't commit suicide collectively real often, and I don't think we're going to do that either. We're going to find our way out of this crisis. Every financial crisis ends. But, you know, the Roman Empire ended too, and the British Empire ended too. And I'd like to see this crisis end in a way that's going to propel America forward and not end America at the same time.
Let's go to Derek. Derek with us from Rond Lake, Illinois.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the air. I'm calling from Northern Illinois, Lake County, where the county has been specifically hard hit. We have almost double-digit unemployment. And frankly, I also would like to address one issue which I think needs to be talked about, is just credibility of your guest. Mr. Friedman is an opportunist and cheerleader for the globalized New World Order, specifically his older book, At This Flat, which I think is a little bit disingenuous. When it comes to taking it into account for his reporting, specifically for someone who actually doesn't speak foreign language, who doesn't have a really intrinsic...
Doesn't speak a foreign language?
You don't.
I don't. I studied Arabic and Hebrew, but what do you know about me?
You know, specifically when you're writing...
I studied both Arabic and Hebrew. I actually got my BA in that undergraduate. So you clearly don't know anything about me. And I'm really not interested in having this conversation. So I'm perfectly ready to talk about, you know, all of these things. But don't make wild allegations. You don't even know what you're talking about.
Well, let me put this in somebody else's voice. George Packer, in his recent blog, said you did seem to be somebody who had inordinate respect for the authorities, many of whom have gotten into this mess. For example, you wrote in another recent column that we ought to have a national get-together where the president says, I'm getting on the helicopter to Camp David. The 20 leading Republicans, the 20 leading Democrats, the bankers, the industrialists, they're all joining me, and we're not going to come down from the mountain until we have a solution to this, suggesting that, well, you know, why those people?
I mean, how do you solve the problem, Neil, if you don't have the bankers who created it, the legislators who need to pass the regulatory and economic reforms and capital to resolve it, and the political figures who need to sell it to the country? Who should be there?
Yet, shouldn't you be looking for new kinds of people to talk to people with new solutions?
You could invite anybody you wanted. The point I was simply making is let's get all the stakeholders together, drop everything, and solve this. My gosh, if you think, you know, somebody better, whether it's left, right, or center, has solutions, of course. But all I was trying to suggest is let's get the people we need in the room, Republicans and Democrats, okay, left and right, bankers, okay, and legislators, and let's solve this thing.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Let's go to Chuck in San Francisco.
Thanks very much. One change I think that's pretty remarkable and I think we need to address is the compensation schemes and the role they've played in the whole system breaking down. The top levels nowadays get paid many, many multiples what the average employee gets paid, and that I don't think was the case a generation or two ago. And I think one way this is especially timely is I think you can point to this whole AIG thing and see that an example of how these bonuses created a kind of a perverse incentive system whereby people can earn so much money in such a short time that there's no incentive for them to think long term, and they're perfectly happy to think short term and construct a system that's going to enrich them tremendously, even if it is going to fall apart in a couple of years, as we are seeing now. So I think it'd be interesting to consider the role that compensation schemes have played in the situation we're in now.
Well, let's hear from Tom Friedman on that.
No, I think, you know, it's called IBG and YBG. I'll be gone and you'll be gone. And that really was the principle. Had really, you know, kind of lubricated this whole crisis. You know, people bought homes who shouldn't have bought homes thinking, I'll be able to flip it, I'll be gone, you know. People gave mortgages to them thinking, well, you know, I just offload this mortgage into a bond or security, I'll be gone. People packaged those mortgages and sold them to your bank or mine and said, I'll be gone. People rated those mortgages from Moody's and Standard & Poor's and got paid lucratively for it and said, I'll be gone. And so, you know, the IBG and YBG were I'll be gone or you'll be gone is one of the reasons we're in all this. And there's no question, you know, I mentioned to on a show this morning that, you know, I live in Montgomery County, Maryland. My wife's a school teacher here. The school teachers in Montgomery County, Maryland gave up their contractually, you know, obligated 5% raise for 2009. For next year, and they did it so more teachers wouldn't be fired and more programs wouldn't be cut. That was in their contract. They had it, just like the bonuses of the AIG people had it. But they voluntarily gave it up. And to me, that's what people at AIG are going to have to do.
I would certainly hope so. But the thing that I'm concerned about mm-hmm. in the discussion of this AIG thing is people are always characterizing the guys getting these bonuses as either fools or perhaps engaged in some kind of fraud or criminal activity and not addressing what seems to me the real problem, which is this perverse incentive structure. And I really hope maybe you guys will talk about that later in the hour.
All right. We're going to focus more on AIG in a little bit, Chuck, but thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking today with Tom Friedman, a columnist for The New York Times, the author most recently of Hot, Flat, and Crowded, Why We Need a Green Revolution and How It Can Renew America. We're talking with him as part of a series of conversations about this American moment, this economic moment, and how it's changing the economy where you live. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-989-8255. If you have a suggestion for somebody we ought to be talking to as part of the series, send it to us by email, and that address is talk@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Hugh on the line. Hugh calling from Oakland, California.
Sure, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk to you. In the past, you've promoted globalization as a solution and also the unbridled success of China. What I'd like to simply ask you is, do you still agree with this? And should unbridled capitalism and purchasing of cheap products is it sustainable, and do you still believe in it?
That's a fair and good question. First of all, I would reject the word unbridled. You know, my whole argument about globalization, if you read either Lexis Nialtree or The World is Flat, is that globalization has really powerful upsides and really powerful downsides. I didn't start it, believe it or not. You know, I just cataloged it. And our job, it seems to me, as citizens, is to get the most out of the upsides and to cushion the downsides. Let's look at both for a second. What were the upsides? The upsides is that thanks to globalization, more people grew out of poverty. More people have grown out of poverty during the last 20 years in places called India and China, Brazil, or Eastern Europe, faster than any time in the history of the world. Okay, and call me, you know, crazy, but I actually get a real kick out of seeing that many people grow out of poverty. Okay, that was actually because of, in part, securitization, access to capital, and movements to markets. All right. That was a reality. But at the same time, this flat world we see even more in this crisis transmits instability and excesses farther and faster than anything we've ever seen before. And so to me, the answer is obviously we've got to step back now, learn from this moment, see what needs to be regulated, and regulate it in wholly new ways. But would you prefer to go back, you know, to a system of socialism? People who lived under that really rejected it. They sort of passed their own judgment on it. So it seems to me you want to move forward. You want to keep a market-based system. You want to encourage the best of globalization, but you want to do it learning from this crisis with new regulations, particularly about leverage. And as far as trade, I still believe in free trade. Absolutely. I believe it's the best way for countries to grow their incomes. I believed it before. I believe it now.
Yeah. And what I'd just like to point out in your promoting of that is that more Americans have fallen into poverty, and some of the inequities that exist in our global trading still today, such as currency and open court systems in China, still don't exist, and some of this was predictable from the beginning, but we unfortunately didn't hear a lot of that from you early on, so now it's harder, as well as other people, of course, I'm not putting it on you, as well as a lot of other people who are promoting it, and I'd just like to see, I think it would be nice to see some balance going forward. So
I appreciate where you're coming from, and you know, all I would say is if you actually read my books, and this is I find a common criticism, if you wrote positively about globalization in any way, you know, really over the last 20 years, you were a spokesman for, a Cassandra for, a Polly, you were a shill for. But if you wrote against globalization, okay, in any way, that was you were a realist, sober, and whatnot. And really, what I tried to do was look at the upsides and the downsides. But if you in any way looked at the upsides for some people, you were somehow, you know, in the tank for globalization, and I just don't accept that. But I hear what you're saying. I know where you're coming from, and I do believe that balance has to be there. And if you don't think it was there in the past, I hope you'll find it there going forward.
And, Tom, we just have a few seconds with you left, but I wanted to ask, when things do start to turn around, what signs will you be looking at?
I'll be looking for the banks. I mean, the first sign will be obviously the market, you know, capital will perceive that there's profit now in investing in these banks. The rules are clear. And I think that's the first thing you'll see. You'll see private money going into the banks, not congressional money. And I think that'll be the first sign that things are changing.
Tom Friedman, as always, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Tom Friedman, a columnist for The New York Times and the author of Hot, Flat, and Crowded, Why We Need a Green Revolution and How It Can Renew America, with us today from his office in Washington. Coming up, Congress and much of the country are furious about the millions of dollars in AIG bonuses. We'll hear an argument about why the best thing for the country may be to let it go and move on. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's The Talk of the Nation from NPR News.